From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll look at the impact lower enrollment from international students could have on Wisconsin universities. Then, we'll explore the history of the recently closed LGBTQ bar, This Is It.
Number one, it's very rare to find a bar that has been operating since before Stonewall. But it's even more rare that the owner's legacy is carried forward decades after they're gone.
Plus, the life partner of iconic astronaut Sally Ride talks about a documentary that shares the complete picture of their love story.
You know, Sally was a very honest person. So it was just this one area of her life that she couldn't navigate because of all of the, well, first of all, just the culture over the years that we were a couple, almost 30 years.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Universities like Harvard and Columbia are dominating the headlines right now regarding uncertainty for international students. But smaller schools in the Midwest are also feeling the impact of student visas getting revoked, ICE raids, and general unease about studying here in the United States. Last week, UWM Chancellor Mark Mone said that the university expects 400 fewer international students to enroll next school year. WUWM education reporter Catherine Kokel is joined by William Brustein, a global higher education strategist who has worked with several Midwestern colleges to boost international enrollment to look at the impact schools are seeing.
University leaders in Wisconsin share that they expect several hundred fewer international students next year. What does it mean to non-Ivy League colleges if they lose international students? We're hearing a lot about Harvard. We're hearing a lot about Columbia. What about colleges and universities in the middle of the country, like state schools?
Well, let me start off by saying that's an excellent question, because the spotlight has been on the Ivy League schools. And most of our students who receive an education in higher education, as well as international students, are not going to those schools. Sure, those schools do have large numbers, but it's this big public land-grant universities like Wisconsin, Indiana, Ohio State, Illinois, the Berkeleys, UCLA. You can go down that list where you find most American students and most international students. Now, with respect to the Midwest in particular, I think there's a reason for major anxiety. First of all, yes, there are schools in the Midwest that are highly, highly selective. Like you'll get the University of Chicago or Northwestern University in Michigan, some of the major land grants. But when you go one or two levels below and you don't have that cachet that's attached to your university, and you're competing for fewer and fewer international students because that market now, because of our policies here in this country, as well as viable options outside of the United States, that it's going to be harder to make up that shortfall. So I definitely believe that the numbers that you've heard are correct, that there's going to be a significant decline. And I think that's going to have a major impact in a number of realms. First of all, the revenue that's brought in by international students. And it's not only that in some cases at public universities, they tend to pay two or three times more than, let's say, an in-state student, but that the money that they would spend in the local community, particularly we're talking about smaller towns where they help the local economy thrive in terms of whether they're renting out accommodations, they're buying food, they're buying other supplies, they may be buying or purchasing an automobile. So in many ways, that's going to have an impact on the local economy. And then we look at within the campus, what's going to happen? Well, I mean, the international students, particularly to the Midwest, where we're not as exposed as much as the East and the West Coast to people from different backgrounds and cultures. It's those areas and those schools that we're going to find are going to lose that type of diverse perspective on issues that's so important to enrich the classroom. So I truly worry about that. But the question then becomes, how will these schools, in, let's say in the Midwest, make up for the decline in international students when at the same time we have an enrollment cliff facing U.S. higher education, and they were not graduating the numbers of 18 to 22-year-olds that we did earlier. So where are you going to go to get that student population if they're not coming from out of state, they're not coming from overseas? So that becomes an issue, particularly for states in the former manufacturing industrial Midwest, the heartland of the United States, because those populations are not growing.
Oh, you bring up such a good point. John Swallow is the president of Carthage College here, and he mentioned that in 15 years, we are going to have 15% fewer students graduating from high school in the United States, and not because of inability to graduate, but because of the lowering birth rate. And so, you know, his institution is tasked with figuring out how to make up the difference.
I think the universities and colleges have to be very bold and innovative. It's not the only population out there, the 18 to 22-year-olds. Let's start thinking of what they can do more with respect to people who have already graduated, who are in their careers, working with the local community, working with businesses in the area to form programs that can help people reskill, or thinking more on what they can do in terms of working more with K through 12 in terms of making up for some of that shortfall.
We've talked a lot about the expected changes in enrollment in the fall, but I do want to ask why. Why are students second-guessing whether they want to come to the United States to study?
Well, because they don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I mean, it's like every day something else hits them, whether it's, you know, revocation of visas or international students being stopped by ICE because maybe they wrote something in the student newspaper or something they might have said or on their social media post. There's this anxiety, this concern, this fear that they would come over here and they would be so concerned about every little word they said, what steps they took, what groups they joined, who they involved themselves with. So it's like it's an unknown what's going to happen next week or in 2 weeks or within a year, the way things have been unfolding over the last few months. So you have that anxiety. Then you have a number of factors that have been at play for a while. Obviously, the cost of higher education for international students who, as I've mentioned before, sometimes at universities, particularly at public universities, pay 2 to 3 times what a domestic student or an in-state student would pay. So when you look at that price tag and you look at, well, what are my other options? And that's an important factor because there are very new and viable options for international students who, given the concerns they have about the United States now, were leading them to think, well, what about Singapore? Fantastic universities, National University of Singapore, Nanyang Technical University, Singapore Management University. What about Hong Kong? Hong Kong's got some, for the Chinese students and mainland China, has some excellent universities. What about Malaysia? Even a little further afield in Europe. Europe is developing and becoming a much more attractive destination, particularly the Netherlands, Germany, France. More and more programs are going over to having English language as the lingua franca for these schools. So there are viable alternatives now to coming to the U.S. So when you look at the bigger picture, with all what's happening in terms of fear that there may be ban on international student enrollments, that your visa can be easily revoked, or that now, and this is a critical time for many students who are overseas who want to now begin the process of applying for their visa to come study in the United States, so that they can come maybe not in September or in the fall, but for the next cycle, that there are right now holdups. I mean, Secretary of State Rubio is saying that we're going to hold up now for a while, that we have to improve the process of vetting social media. So when you have that added to all the unknowns, the knowns and the unknowns with respect to what's going on in the U.S. in terms of attacks on higher education and the less than friendly international student environment, that's why it's not too hard to see that what's going to happen this fall and ensuing semesters, that the numbers are going to decline. So that's why I believe that the picture is not a rosy one in the near future.
William Brustein is a global strategist for international higher education and professor emeritus at West Virginia University and the University of Pittsburgh. He spoke with WUWM education reporter Catherine Kokel. June Brehm opened her bar This Is It, located just off of Cathedral Square, in August of 1968. At the time, Milwaukee had almost three dozen gay bars, but Brehm wanted to create a space for her LGBTQ friends that was of better quality and with a sense of unapologetic inclusion. Brehm ran This Is It for just over 56 years, followed by her son Joe, then owner George Schneider. It became the longest-running gay bar in Wisconsin and was one of the 10 oldest in the nation. This Is It abruptly closed on March 9th, and the LGBT community is still mourning the loss of this legacy space. For this month's Milwaukee Magazine, writer Michael Takash explores the history, legacy, and sense of community that This Is It fostered over the decades. He joins me now to share more and starts by explaining what motivated June Brehm to open the bar.
June was, you know, not part of the LGBT community. She was a mom. She was a married woman. She was someone who had worked in the service industry. And she lived in the suburbs and wanted to open a place of her own. And the service industry traditionally and historically has been a place where there are a lot of LGBT people. So she had a lot of LGBT friends. But she saw what they had to put up with. She saw the bars that had low lighting, that had no front doors, that only could be accessed through alleyways or side doors or unmarked entrances. She saw bars that didn't have reliable plumbing, running water. And the thing that annoyed her the most was that none of the drinks ever had ice and were never cold. And, you know, she really made a commitment to her gay friends that, you know, she was going to find them a place that was better, that they could hang out, where they would be treated as well, if not better, than anywhere else in town. And over time, they're like, well, how's that going, June? Have you found our spot yet? And she's like, you know what? I'll find a spot. Trust me, even if I have to open it myself. And ultimately, that's what she did. She opened This Is It with a business partner. And, you know, there have been so many, again, so much folklore around June's intentions. I've heard everything from she was a mafia mole who got this who got this bar in a breakup. I was told that, you know, she was, you know, a lesbian and had a girlfriend. I was told that, you know, This Is It was never a gay bar. It was never intended to be a gay bar. And I've often heard the legend that This Is It never had a sign and was actually a speakeasy, and that its origins even predated 1968 and went all the way back to Prohibition. And none of these stories that I just shared are true. The real story of This Is It is far more fascinating. Here you have an ally, a mother, a wife, a straight woman who wanted to help out her friends and create a place where they could go and be safe and be welcome and not have any trouble. And that's the legacy she launched. And, you know, one thing we talked about in the Milwaukee Magazine article is that She created this bar with a legacy of unapologetic inclusion, where everyone was welcome. It didn't matter if you were black, if you were a woman, if you were gay, if you were straight, if you were trans. Like, over the course of time, everyone walked through those doors and everyone was treated the same way by her son, by future owners, and by future staff. And I just think that that's fascinating because, number one, it's very rare to find a bar that has been operating since before Stonewall. But it's even more rare that the owner's legacy is carried forward decades after they're gone.
Yeah. And on that note, one thing I want to talk about that is a tradition June started is the slideshow of photos. And I love this aspect. And the fact that it kept going up until its closure is pretty amazing. So can you tell us more about it and why it's unique at a gay bar especially?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, it wasn't really popular to take cameras to gay bars, and there were a number of reasons for this. So even if it was a party, if it was Christmas, if it was someone's birthday, if it was, you know, a celebration, cameras still were kind of sketchy. I mean, someone who brought a camera to a bar had a secret intention. They had some type of agenda. They were out to accomplish something untoward. So cameras were always seen with skepticism and rarely allowed. If you pulled out a camera, you might be asked to either put it away or leave. And the reason was that many of the employees and customers felt that they would be blackmailed. They felt that photos would be taken them of this in this space. In a time before anti-discrimination protections, they feared that they would lose their jobs, they could be evicted from their apartments. And of course, this was also a time when it was still technically illegal to serve alcohol or allow homosexuals to gather in a public place that was licensed by the city, county, or state. And people forget that there was a time where that was actually the law. You could not serve people who were known to be gay. And June was anti-discrimination long before it was popular and long before it was legal. She didn't care that people didn't want to be photographed, and she didn't care that people might be blackmailed. She knew that these were her friends and that she knew that they deserved to be photographed, they deserved to be seen, they deserved to have a sense of community. So starting in the 70s, she started taking a lot of photos. Later there were Polaroids. Later there were 35 millimeter photos. But she started taking photos of events. And over time, she accumulated thousands and thousands of these printed photos, which eventually became a slideshow in the bar. In the age of digital photos, after June and her son Joe left the business, this slideshow just continued to grow and grow and grow. So a fun tradition of going to this is it was having your photo taken, being added to the, you know, the legacy and history of the bar, and being seen on the TV monitors months, weeks, years after the photos were taken. And it really created a bit of a living history for this space and a sense of connection that people really valued.
Now, being a bar that opened in the late 60s, obviously there were some changes, but what I loved about this place was that it didn't change for a long time. So it did kind of start off or was known for being an older gay gentleman's space. So how did it go from there and how did that kind of change over time?
Yeah, so the bar was opened, you know, in 1968 for June and her friends, right? And I mean, these were men of a certain generation. This is the pre-Stonewall era. These were people who were, you know, born in the late 40s and the 50s and so forth. And, you know, this was a generation that was deeply impacted by the AIDS crisis. And a lot of those people who were there in the beginning of This Is It were lost the AIDS crisis. And, you know, by all rights, that could have very well shut down the bar as it shut down many bars around the country. Over time, you know, new generations stepped in and people started coming. But I think the thing that's really interesting is that, like, even, you know, when I was younger, like, we wouldn't go to This Is It. It was not a place for people in their 20s. It was not a place that was seen as fun. It was not a place that was seen as cool. It was a place that, you know, older gentlemen went to, older white, gay, cisgender gentlemen. And it was their space. It was not our space. So they were very clear about this. So I think that, you know, it's fascinating to see that over time, you know, that evolved dramatically. And, you know, right around the time Mad Men was popular, it had a massive comeback because people really appreciated the cocktail culture of the Mad Men era, the aesthetic of the Mad Men era, the look and feel of the late 1960s cocktail culture. And it really came into vogue. And I mean, there were nights, weeknights, like, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday nights where that place would be at capacity. And that was not something people would have ever anticipated or expected. And I think that that really was the beginning of this is it turning a corner. That was in the last few years of June's life. She passed away in 2010. I think it shocked her that the bar was making this comeback because, you know, a lot of those older gentlemen no longer went out. And, you know, now there was this new generation coming in and they were all very, very interested and committed to being part of this history.
With this history of this space and how it changed over time, what I think remained true in its many iterations and kind of what you touched upon earlier is that it always remained a true and honest community. And you spoke with people who have worked there or spent time there, New June, a lot of iterations of this space has touched a lot of people. So as you were collecting people's reactions and memories, what does it mean to you for a building to become this legacy space?
Yeah, I think that was the most important part of the article for me was hearing the perspectives from so many different angles, right? I mean, these were people from different generations, different backgrounds, different lived experiences, different communities. And, you know, they each had something to reflect upon and to contribute to the article. And I think that it really collectively shows that, you know, June's original intention of creating a space for her gay, male, cisgender friends evolved, expanded, and adapted to a space for everyone, a space where everyone who needed a space could find it, a space where people who needed, you know, a community could build one. You know, the building itself is now empty, but there are still people going there and still lighting candles and writing chalk messages in front of the bar. And the fact that people gathered outside the bar within 15 minutes of the bar's closing announcement, which was abrupt with no advance warning, but still people showed up and people were there and they were celebrating in person together, shows that this was more than just a physical address. It was a spiritual experience that will last and stay with people. And maybe that experience, you know, is now over, but the memories remain and the impact remains. And, you know, the spiritual value of having this place remains.
Since that abrupt closure in March, the building was recently nominated for historic status, but that was recently withdrawn as well. So outside of people kind of making their own ways of remembering this is it, how do you think we should be marking this bar's impact and, you know, why this closing matters more than ever?
So, yes, it was interesting to see the building nominated for Historic Preservation Commission review in the city of Milwaukee. The History Project is not entirely sure that was the right form of designation because it protects the architecture. And that's not really what This Is It is all about. It's not the physical building that made it special. It was the experiences and the community and the connectivity and the history that happened there. So, you know, I don't think the story is over yet. I think that there is more to come on the historic designation field. And that's about all I can say about that for now. But just know that there are efforts underway to make sure that this place is remembered, commemorated, and preserved for future generations to know it was there and that it was important and that it was special. And although there are other bars in town and throughout the state, certainly, there aren't as many as there used to be. And I think that's something that people should know. I mean, at the turn of the century, there were still 24 gay bars in Milwaukee, and now there are 7. And only one of those bars has opened in this decade. The rest have been open for quite a while. And all of them are likely struggling because nightlife, since the pandemic, isn't what it used to be. When I met with the owner of This Is It last summer, right after Pride Fest, and, you know, asked, you know, what was his message for the community, it was to come out and support them. They'd been struggling with a road project that had kind of rendered them inaccessible for almost a year. It really seemed like that block of downtown had been blockaded from business. And we say it all the time, but I mean, people need to check up on their bars. They need to know how the bars are doing, how the owners are doing, how the staff are doing. If you love these places as much as you say you do when they're closing, take some time to support them while they're alive. Because, you know, as one of the commentators says in the article, these are not profitable ventures. People keep these open due to their commitment to the community. They want to honor the legacy of those who came before them, and they work hard, extended hours, 7 days a week, putting themselves in financial debt and beyond, just to keep these spaces open. And if the community doesn't show up for the spaces won't be there. And that's the hard lesson of This Is It, is that eventually even popular, longtime, established, historic businesses can and will close if they don't have the right level of support.
Well, Micah, I want to thank you for your work on the article and sharing some of the history and also some of the current memories of This Is It. And as you said, we'll see what's to come in the future.
Thank you.
Michael Takash is a writer, and you can find his article called This Was It, Why the Closing of Wisconsin's Oldest Gay Bar Matters More Than Ever, in this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Did you know you can listen to Like Effect as a podcast? Search for Like Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen to us on demand. In about 10 minutes, we'll tell you about the documentary Sally, which explores the secret relationship Sally Ride hid from the public for years. But first, we'll share the history of Juneteenth. Keep listening to Like Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Like Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Juneteenth is later this week. The holiday commemorates the day in 1865 that enslaved Black Americans in Galveston, Texas, were told they had been freed. The announcement came 2 years after President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, a document that freed slaves in all states that rebelled against the Union. Juneteenth became a federally recognized holiday in 2021 and an official City of Milwaukee holiday in 2022. Milwaukee was one of the first northern cities to start celebrating Juneteenth and has one of the longest-running Juneteenth Day celebrations. To examine the history of the holiday, WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell speaks with Dr. Robert Baker, a visiting assistant professor at UW-Milwaukee in the African and American Diaspora Studies Department.
What do you know about how those early celebrations looked?
Yeah, it was a celebration of food, singing, and joy. I mean, obviously, a year after slavery, people weren't rolling up in the Harley Davidsons or on their motorcycles or coming out in super fancy clothes, but it was a time of remembrance and hope. And so that first Juneteenth Day, which is this June and 19th smashed together, that first Juneteenth Day kicked off a cultural practice that started in the South and, you know, really pushed throughout the South, throughout and the North after the Great Migration in 1971 in Milwaukee, we have our first Juneteenth celebration. So I can imagine it was a time of hope and love. Mm.
And so you mentioned just that those celebrations traveling from the South to the North, and Milwaukee has been one of the cities that I believe has one of the longest Juneteenth celebrations. What do you think that says about Milwaukee, that this festival has been able to succeed this long?
Yeah, I mean, the beautiful thing about Milwaukee is that we have a lot of love, hope, and pride and connection to our Black culture. And even though African Americans didn't start moving to Milwaukee until the late 50s, what you see by 1970 is an explosion of our Black community. And so as African Americans were coming north, they settled. This is one of the best places in the country for Blacks to be. And so I think it was a celebration of hope, freedom, but also about Black success. Mm. So I think we still have a lot of successful, freedom-loving Black people, and we're going to show up on King Drive until we can't.
Absolutely. So Juneteenth finally became a federally recognized holiday in 2021. Joe Biden signed the Juneteenth National Independence Day Act into law. And, you know, that was thanks to some Black women like Opal Lee and Lula Briggs Galloway and other supporters who just really advocated for years for that to become a reality. What do you think is the significance of this federal acknowledgement?
Yeah, I mean, the last federal holiday was in 1993, and it was Martin Luther King Day. And so we fast forward, you know, over 30 years, and we have Juneteenth Day. And I think it's about a statement by the federal government that African Americans are just now finally getting acknowledged. Their history is just finally getting acknowledged. And while we're grateful for President Biden for passing this holiday, it shows that Black people in this country have to struggle to get acknowledged. Shouldn't have taken that long.
Mm. And so why do you think it took till 2021 for Juneteenth to be federally recognized?
I think it took so long for Juneteenth to be recognized because even though a lot of our population has moved on and has acknowledged that racism and racial oppression is something that is still exists today, there are many leaders who want to hide from our past. And even today, we're seeing a lot of people sort of put down Black history and some of the critical thought that's connected to it. And so I think there's a resistance to acknowledge that African Americans have a different history in the United States. July 4th, 1776, many of us were still in bondage. At the end of slavery, 4 million Black people are still enslaved. And so it was a resistance and the slow moving nature of accepting our story. But, you know, Black people, we turn up. And so we know what happened in 2021.
Absolutely. And that's actually what my next question was, is like those events of 2020 with George Floyd being killed and the country having what some called a racial reckoning. You think that helped push that effort for federal acknowledgement?
Yeah, I think that if there had not been the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter moment and movement that took place after the death of George Floyd, I don't think President Biden would have set the federal holiday. And, you know, Frederick Douglass, our great ancestor, said that there is no progress without struggle. You know, and so I think that every time Black people and our allies and people who are concerned about racism and oppression step up and use our voice in unison, that's when we get stuff done.
So I'm really like harping on this federal acknowledgement. You know, as with any major holiday, you have companies, for example, that would try to capitalize off it, right? You have the sales, the slogans, social media messaging. Sometimes that really just looks like lip service to some people. Considering that, do you worry that the true meaning of the holiday might be lost because of things like that?
Yes, I think that we're in this phase in which it's becoming apparent that corporate America is grabbing on to Juneteenth and sort of what some people might say commodifying it. Mm. And I do think we have a danger with any holiday with just using it as a time to sell goods or tell surface level stories. So I do think that we need to be concerned about that. But I do also believe it's a time for Black people to get in where we fit in. Mm. You know, over the last 2 years, I've been approached by corporate institutions and nonprofits that had never considered talking about Juneteenth. And they brought me in to talk to their staffs. And I know that I'm not the only historian doing that. I know there are a lot of leaders that are sort of being more thoughtful. And so, yeah, this is America. We like to sell products. But I do believe that more good will come from this than anything that's bad.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear. If we have those companies like you're talking about and just people in general who are serious about acknowledging the day, you know, beyond a day off, how can they truly share that they care about this holiday or care that the holiday commemorates Black people's liberation?
Yeah, I mean, I believe that there will be a lot of people who would continually just get off, you know, and do their thing, not pay one second of attention to Juneteenth Day. But, you know, if you're an ally or a parent or someone that's concerned about the state of the country or the world, I really encourage you to check out the great books that are online about Juneteenth. There's great YouTube videos, important Wikipedia pages. And I would ask that you spend at least a moment reflecting with your children or your loved ones and tell a story about how a group of people who had been in bondage really turned up for the entire country. After slave reform, enslaved people started Memorial Days. They started private schools. They started public schools. They built roads and railroads. And so much of our history is taught through the lens that Black people have these pathologies or problems. But when we look at those formerly enslaved people, they showed up with joy and love. And so I feel like that's something that all of us need to do and need to reflect on.
So I guess my final question, you know, we talked about this nation really being, there being some resistance to acknowledging that Black folks have a different history in this country. There's was the slow moving nature to acknowledge Juneteenth as this holiday. What would appropriate recognition from America for Juneteenth look like to you?
Yeah, I think the appropriate sort of recognition of Juneteenth would start with federal agencies and local governments sort of investing in the holiday beyond just sort of slogans or putting up flags, but investing it in the same way we do July 4th, having park resources, neighborhood resources that allow people, Black people especially, to celebrate their connection to this American story. I feel like because there's been this slow recognition, many of us to this day don't feel like Americans fully. And so if Black people are going to be at the center of the conversation and not at the margins, we need to invest. But I do know that there's a lot of heavy baggage that all of us feel because of slavery. And the more we look at it head on the face and acknowledge it, the better our country will be.
I want to leave space for you to share any final thoughts that you have.
Yeah, I appreciate you putting a spotlight on Juneteenth. I think Milwaukee's Juneteenth Day is especially important and magical. If you go to the Juneteenth Wikipedia page, a picture of Milwaukee will be there because our Juneteenth Day is so massive. And so I appreciate that. I appreciate anyone paying attention to Black history because it's American history. And we can never forget the path that this country has taken to get here today.
Well, Dr. Baker, thank you so much for having this conversation with me. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate you. Thank you.
Dr. Robert Baker is a visiting assistant professor at UW-Milwaukee in the African and African Diaspora Studies Department. He spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell, in 2023. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk going, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Almost 42 years after the flight that made Sally Ride America's first woman in space, the documentary called Sally follows Ride's NASA career and her hidden relationship with her life partner, Tam O'Shaughnessy. We'll speak with Tam coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Sally Ride became the first American woman in space on June 18, 1983. The soft-spoken physicist became an icon and was thrust into the spotlight as soon as she landed back on Earth. But beneath her unflappable composure, she carried a secret. A documentary called Sally reveals the 27-year-long romance with her partner, Tam O'Shaughnessy. O'Shaughnessy is one of the subjects of Sally, as well as an executive producer of the documentary. It's directed by Milwaukee native and Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Christina Costantini. They join me to talk about the film, and Costantini begins by explaining how her interest in Sally Ride started long before she began work on the documentary.
I mean, I've been obsessed with Sally since I was a kid, really, I think second or third grade. I learned that Sally Ride went to space. And I thought, I think like many girls, if a girl can do that, maybe I can do big things too. And I admired her. I thought she looked cool in her jumpsuit. I thought she looked sporty and brave. And so, you know, I loved her so much. I was given the assignment in third grade to paint on the side of my elementary school, Golden Meir, a mural of Sally on 4th Street, I believe. a mural of my hero. And so she's next to Brett Favre and Michael Jordan. And I chose Sally, and she's still there now. So if you drive past.
I definitely am going to drive past. Here. Yes.
She's looking at a portrait of the Challenger, and it's so funny that it's still there to this day. But I've been obsessed with Sally since I was a girl. And that's the power of somebody like Sally and her legacy is, you know, she was the first American woman ever to do it. And that will forever be very, very inspiring to young women.
Absolutely. And before we get into the documentary that you did, Tam, I want to bring you in here. You met Sally first when you were 12. She was 13. You both were playing tennis. And you kind of re-entered each other's orbits sporadically, you know, throughout your life until you decided to make a relationship happen, despite the challenges. And some people listening to this today may, or watching the movie during the film fest, may be learning this aspect about Sally for the first time with this documentary. So can you share a bit about your lives together and why Sally felt it was necessary to hide your relationship while she was alive?
Sure. We had an amazing life together, you know, starting as young girls and becoming great friends through tennis. And then sometimes I would go when there were tennis tournaments in Los Angeles, I'd go and stay with her family. I lived kind of in between Los Angeles and San Diego. And throughout our teenage years, we were in each other's lives and seeing each other as friends. And then I went off to study biology, and Sally stayed at Stanford to continue studying physics. And I moved to Atlanta, where I live now. And when Sally was selected to be the first American woman in space, every astronaut was allowed to send out 50 invitations to friends and family. And she called and sent me an invitation. And I hadn't talked to her in a couple of years. You know, we were both busy with our work and our lives. And I was thrilled to get an invitation. And it was spectacular watching the launch. And I didn't get to see her, of course, because she was in quarantine. But then after that, that was in June 1983. And, you know, after she landed back on Earth, she started giving talks around the country. And whenever she came, first of all, she was very smart. She'd pick cities where her friends lived so that she could, you know, go out to dinner, go see a movie, or do something fun with somebody that she knew and liked. So when she started coming to Atlanta to give talks, she'd call me and we'd get together and, you know, take a walk, go out to eat or whatever. And that started happening fairly frequently for various things that she was doing. And we basically reestablished our friendship. And then it became romantic one early evening. But Sally, I think her experiences being famous, she was already a private person. That's how she grew up. Her parents are very private. Her sister's private. It's just part of who she is. But then I think her experiences becoming this celebrity, kind of an overnight famous person, was very hard on her because she was kind of a quiet introvert. So I think that's the primary reason that she just didn't really think it was anybody else's business. But I do think if we had stayed in academia, if we were both professors at universities, it just would have been easier, simpler to be more open with more people. But we started a company, Sally Ride Science, which is now a nonprofit at the University of California, San Diego. And once we did that, we knew that the viability of the company depended on corporate sponsorships. And there was no way. We started the company in 2001. There was just no way that we would get sponsorships from General Electric or Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, you know, ExxonMobil, you name it, if they knew that two women who were involved as a couple, you know, ran the company. So it was kind of a combination of things for Sally. And, you know, she had a lot more to lose, I think, than I did at the time. But despite that, I mean, our friends and families knew we traveled together, went to each other's events. So in a way, we were quite open, but we just didn't, you know, Sally never said, you know, to a friend of hers or kind of an acquaintance of hers, you know, I'd like you to meet my partner, Tam, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. And this documentary really, you helped to fill in the picture, you know, of Sally's life outside of the icon that most of the public sees her as. And Christina, as much as you're an incredibly skilled filmmaker, Sally would not be the film that it is without you, Tam. So can you both share with me how this project came to be? You know, Tam, did you want to share Sally's story in a deeper way for a while? Or Christina, did you have this film? And then as you met Tam, a new story emerged.
Well, for my part, I have been obsessed with Sally for a long time. And then when she passed away in 2012, I found out about Tam with the rest of the world. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, if NASA was barely ready for women, I doubt they were ready for this. I wonder what that was like at the time. And so I thought about this movie for a long time. And I finally got up the courage to email National Geographic and the woman who runs that department. And she said, you know what, we're actually already working on a Sally Ride film, and we have Tam O'Shaughnessy. Would you be interested in working on that film with us? And I said, of course. So it was kind of between Story Syndicate, who is a production company on the film, and Tam and myself. And it was a real dream come true and a real privilege to be able to tell the story. But I still was not sure that the film would totally work until I met Tam. Because Sally was such a private person, I didn't know if we would be able to scratch the surface of who she really was. Because based on her public appearances, she was so great in public, but a perfect hero story is only so interesting to me. So, you know, Tam is like a godsend to a documentary filmmaker. She's brilliant. She's really well-spoken. She has a great sense of humor and an incredible memory. And most importantly, she has the desire to tell us about who Sally really was. I think Tam wanted to say, you know, Sally was human. And to me, that's much more inspirational and much more relatable, that our heroes are real people and we can see ourselves in them. And so Tam was really the secret to making the documentary work. And I wanted to tell a story that paid homage to this story that was unfolding as this American history was also unfolding. And so the film is the very public story of who Sally Ride was, and a more private, in my view, more romantic story of what was happening underneath the surface that we didn't know about at the time. So I, you know, I want to celebrate Sally for who she really was and celebrate Tam along with it.
Yeah, along with it. Absolutely. And it is the love story that is most impactful. And Tam, since you were already kind of in the works on this project, can you share some of the challenges? Because not only are you a subject of the film, you're also an executive producer. So what was it like for you to balance, okay, also retelling an emotional and very personal side of yours and Sally's life, but also having that EP mindset and knowing all the logistics that have to be sorted out?
Yeah, I wanted the film to be successful. You know, Christina committed, I committed, Nat Geo was behind it, Story Syndicate, and I wanted all of our efforts to be successful. I wanted people to know who Sally was. And, you know, one of the reasons I wanted the film made was that most people think of Sally as the famous astronaut, first American woman to fly in space. But she was so much more than that. You know, she was an athlete, she was a science writer, she was an entrepreneur, she advised presidents on space policy and science education policy. So I kind of wanted the full picture of Sally told to the world so that people could see how interesting and fun and funny and all sorts of things. And also, shortly before Sally passed away, you know, maybe a week or so, I talked to her about who I was going to be to the public once, you know, once she was gone. And, you know, I was upstairs sitting on the edge of her hospice bed and we were talking about it. And she just said, she thought about it for a minute. And then she just sort of said, you do what you think is best. Whatever you decide is fine, will be the right thing to do. And I really loved that. And I just thought, I don't really want a TV movie made about Sally because they're going to take too many, you know, liberties on the truth. And I really wanted a documentary. And then meeting Christina and also the guy who's one of the co-founders of Story Syndicate, it was just a match made in heaven. I felt that they wanted the same thing I wanted from the film. And I just, you know, Sally was a very honest person. So it was just this one area of her life that she couldn't navigate because of all of the, well, first of all, just the culture over the years that we were a couple, almost 30 years, you know, it's not exactly a safe place to be. Anyway, it all just kind of came together with Christina. And I think the story itself just sort of evolved as Christina was interviewing folks and getting a grip on what the story could be. And I'm very proud of the film.
But there's a full moon rising. Let's go dancing in the light.
Christina Costantini is the director of the new documentary, Sally. Tam O'Shaughnessy is the executive producer of the film, as well as one of its main subjects. We spoke earlier this year when the documentary opened the Milwaukee Film Festival. And if you didn't get a chance to see it then, Sally is now available to stream on Nat Geo TV, Disney Plus, and Hulu. And that wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at what's happened since Anodyne workers voted on an effort to unionize. Plus, in a new Wandering Wisconsin, we'll tell you about a popular music series in Madison. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.